Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
It's very hard to provide a brief introduction to Lynn Scarlett, I have to tell you. She is, I'll just say in a nutshell, she's had a very kind of broad level of engagement in environmental policy in the U.S., and she's been influential really at the highest levels of U.S. environmental policy formulation and implementation. Most recently, she spent 8 years in the Department of Interior. She was the Assistant Secretary for Operations, Budget, and Management. Did I get that right?
Close.
And then she, after that, for 4 years, became a Deputy Secretary in Interior and also the Chief Operating Officer for the Department of Interior. Served with two secretaries, Gail Norton and Dirk Kempthorne, and between the two was actually the Acting Secretary of Interior as well. So a very high-level, very influential person in federal environmental policy. Just a couple of other things to mention about her. She told me that she's here for a couple of weeks as our distinguished visitor, and this is a break after 20,000 meetings in the Department of Interior during her stay there. So I guess this feels a little reflective compared to what you've been doing for the last 8 years. This is a bit of a homecoming for her as well. She was an undergraduate and a graduate student here, has degrees, both undergraduate and graduate degrees in political science. While she's here, one of the things she's been reflecting about is cities meet nature, responding to a changing climate. So without further ado, it's a great pleasure to welcome Lynn Scarlett.
I left the world of public policy thought to enter the world of policy decisions and management. I had the great, great privilege of working with the Department of the Interior. The job was a tough one, as Frank noted. When I left the department, my executive assistant handed me a CD with my entire schedule for the 8 years on it. She said, "Guess how many meetings you had, Lynn?" I said, "I have no idea." She said, "20,000. Holy smokes. So Frank is right, not a lot of time to think during those 8 years, a lot of meetings. The job was a tough one, as I said, but phenomenal experiences too. I had the chance just down the road in Ventura County to hold a California condor in my arms, help with the blood testing for lead levels in it, and then release the bird into the wild. I had the chance to stand in the Yukon River in a neoprene suit, catching salmon by hand, weighing and measuring it, plucking the scales off, which it turns out one can utilize to age the salmon. I also had a great time swatting the mosquitoes, which by legend are as large as hummingbirds, and I think it's true. I had the chance to climb into a shark tank in Veracruz, Mexico, whereupon I was given a slab of tuna, which we stuck through a hole, and the shark came right up and gobbled it eye to eye with me. Of course, I felt right at home after my years in Washington. Interior has a spectacular mission, one that I enjoyed going in, but truly grew to love through my 8 years. It manages one in every 5 acres of this great nation, 20% of the landmass. Its responsibilities span 12 time zones, all the way from American Samoa to the Virgin Islands, and its responsibilities go pole to pole from the Arctic to the Antarctic, in the Antarctic where the U.S. Geological Survey does research. When I think about the mission of the department, that mission lies at the confluence of people, land, and water. That often means conflict. Throw a dart on the map at any one of those 2,400 locations where the department has an office, and one often will find one's work in the headlines. Water, energy, wildland fire, endangered species, outdoor recreation, hurricanes, earthquakes, these were our daily fare. These were the headlines that made up Interior's mission. One topic, though, loomed increasingly important through my time at Interior, and that topic was climate change. Much of the nation's climate policy, as we all know here, centers on greenhouse gases. How can we reduce our carbon footprint? That focus is important. It invokes complex questions of how much reductions to achieve, over what time frame, who pays, and how do we structure the processes for reduction. As the nation contemplates those questions, however, I think another tableau of policy puzzles present themselves. Current accumulation of greenhouse gases will persist well into the future. U.S. Geological Survey told me that even if we were to turn off the greenhouse gas switch 100% tomorrow, the current accumulations and their persistence would actually result in a continuing unfolding of effects of climate change on the lands, water, and wildlife around us. So with those continuing unfolding of effects on the landscape, that means that a changing climate is creating a second set of policy puzzles. The effects of climate change cut a broad swath across the landscape. They touch the countryside, much of which comes under the dominion of Interior. But so too does climate change touch our cities, our human settlements, and our infrastructure networks. And today I want to explore climate change in the context of cities. Think a little bit about how one begins to rethink our cities in a context of a changing climate and address some of those effects that are unfolding before us. Now, what's my central thesis? We live in a dynamic world. There is nothing new about that. But the pace of change is increasingly rapid in a changing climate context, and the scope of change is also immense. The pace and scope of changes amplify the importance, I believe, in resilience, building resilience into our infrastructure systems, but also amplify the importance of what I will call integrated problem solving. What does a problem solving framework of resilience and integration mean for our cities? Now, I want to step back in time for a moment. Let's go back in history to set the stage for this discussion. In the 1930s, Los Angeles down the road began paving the Los Angeles River to flush waters out to sea. Now much of the 52 miles of that river is a concrete corridor. But Los Angeles was not alone in that paving endeavor. In the 20th century, cities across America from Los Angeles to Miami tamed urban rivers and streams. Urban planning tools of choice in the 20th century called for taking nature out of cities, directing rivers and streams through tunnels, steering them through engineered channels, walling them off with levees. Wetlands gave way to development. Trees became street ornaments, offering an occasional shaded haven in an occasional park. Paved surfaces and highly fragmented green space characterized and still do the urban landscape. This 21st century, cities are beginning to change, restoring nature and its functions to the metropolis. 70 years after Los Angeles began its major paving of the LA River, the city is now chipping away at that concrete. The river is becoming a river again. Now, across the nation, this urban greening is gaining momentum. Early greening efforts responded to our aesthetic yearnings for perhaps softer, gentler urban places and spaces. But recent greening endeavors are anchored in a fundamental focus on something larger than aesthetics, focused on city functions and services, their costs, and their performance, especially performance amid the challenges presented by climate change. Now, that focus has prompted, I think, a fresh look at what I will call nature. Others call this ecosystem services. I find when I talk to the general public, they look a little bit blankly when I use that term. So natural landscapes purify water and absorb pollutants from the air. They help regulate climate, maintain cooler temperatures through shading. Natural systems help protect coastal communities from catastrophic storms. They prevent erosion. Urban greening is not new, but it is gaining a new momentum. Now, anticipation of the effects of a changing climate on cities and their surroundings is augmenting these greening efforts, as I noted a moment ago. Cities share with the nation significant challenges in managing water to assure clean, fresh supplies, in managing water to treat wastewater and stormwater runoff, in avoiding flooding and other adverse impacts of extreme storm events. Climate change is augmenting those old challenges and introducing new ones. Consider Chicago for a moment. Chicago, a leader in urban greening, actually undertook the development of a climate change action plan. In doing so, they looked at some research and modeling relevant to Chicago and its circumstance, and in their report noted that the city could experience extreme heat events in summer, many more heavy rainstorms, and growing flood risks as a consequence. Chicago managers, drawing on climate modeling and other research, estimate that the number of days over 100 degrees Fahrenheit in Chicago could increase from the current 2 or 3 days per year to as many as 31 days per year. Now, climate impacts complicate the management of our cities and their services. Can current city forms and city infrastructure meet the needs of communities in this changing environment? Let me briefly review for us the state of our communities and that infrastructure that is going to need to continue to serve us, and serve us in the context of these changing circumstances. Much urban water infrastructure is old, even antiquated. The Environmental Protection Agency reports that each year we have 240,000 water main breaks in the United States. The U.S. Geological Survey estimates that water lost from water distribution systems is about 1.7 trillion gallons per year, with a national cost pegged at about 2.8 billion, that's with a B, dollars per year. Now, one estimate puts the total infrastructure backlog needs of the nation with a $390 billion price tag over the next two decades. That's the cost to update or replace wastewater systems using current technologies. Washington, D.C. alone, where I now reside, is embarking on some new infrastructure for stormwater, which is going to cost the city about $2.2 billion. Now, we all know the challenges that city faces to meet the educational needs of its citizens and other dimensions of quality of life. $2.2 billion, a big suck on those resources of that community. In Philadelphia, revising its system of combined sewage and stormwater pipes into separate systems would require transforming 1,600 miles of pipes. That is not a cheap endeavor. Now, alongside of aging infrastructure, we face challenges of new demands. Demands for water have grown, in part due to a 30% increase in the U.S. population from 1980 to 2005. Population growth has been especially rapid in the arid West. Nevada's population grew a staggering 202% over 25 years. Arizona, our neighbor, at a rate of about 119% over that same time period. Now, water use is increasing at the same time that supplies in some areas may be actually more constrained in a changing climate. Now, we all know that, of course, as we look at climate change, the effects of climate on the landscape will vary place to place, some places wetter, some places drier, but some analyses at least suggest that one of the places that will be drier will be the Southwest, the very place with those extreme levels of population growth. Now, urban water use and water management often remain locked within the limitations of old infrastructure. This infrastructure has contributed to increased storm water runoff and has not facilitated water conservation. Impermeable surfacing, in particular, contributes significantly to stormwater runoff. The 2008 State of the Nation's Ecosystem Report of the Heinz Center reported that nearly 60% of our urban and suburban landscapes had more than 30% impermeable surface coverage in those urbanized areas, adversely impacting stream ecosystems. Now, with the paving of city surfaces has also come a loss of tree cover in urban areas. East of the Mississippi, one estimate puts tree cover decline at about 30% over the last 20 years, while the urban footprint has grown about 20%. Now, an estimated $634 million, and this is just a kind of a crude estimate, but an estimate that 634 million trees are missing, if you will, from the urban areas across the United States has resulted from the urbanization and suburbanization in recent decades. Yet think about those trees and their loss. Trees help manage stormwater by intercepting rainfall and slowing the rate at which it runs over the surface of the land and seeps into the ground. The loss of urban trees, by some estimates, may have cost cities some $100 billion in increased stormwater management infrastructure needs. Existing infrastructure also results in extensive missed opportunities for water conservation. Most city infrastructure distributes potable drinking water for all urban water needs, from drinking water to laundry to toilet flushing to landscape irrigation. Per capita residential water consumption in the United States is estimated at about 161 gallons per capita per day in the late 90s. That figure is fourfold higher than some of our developed nation counterparts in Europe. Just a fraction of U.S. public water supply treated to drinking water standards is actually used for drinking. Nearly 60% of this drinking water supply is actually used outdoors for gardening, swimming pools, and related uses. One-third of indoor water is used by indoor toilets, 20% for bathing, 27% for clothes and dishwashing. Now, very little of that water, until recently, has been reclaimed and reused. Some of the high U.S. water consumption may be linked to low-priced water rates. Water use rates in the United States, water price rates in the United States, for example, are less than half the rates charged in the United Kingdom or France. Per capita consumption of water from public drinking water systems in the U.S. is estimated at more than double the level of those two countries that have the significantly higher water prices. Now, rates are also not often linked to costs, with water rate revenues insufficient to cover long-term operating costs as well as capital replacement costs. Reliance on gray infrastructure, the term I use as a juxtaposition to green infrastructure, contributes to water consumption challenges. Urbanization and land transformation result in reduced water infiltration into the soil and increased runoff to surface water, as I noted a moment ago. Perhaps the most notable challenges of 20th century infrastructure, though, relate to storms and flooding. Urban infrastructure has had some significant unintended consequences. Channelizing urban streams and rivers to move water out to sea, for example, along the Gulf Coast, has resulted in massive losses of sea marshes and coastal wetlands. The U.S. Geological Survey, I loved being in a department with USGS. You could call them up, and anytime you had an issue you needed addressed or needed a science answer for, there they were. But USGS reports that the Louisiana coast lost more than 1,900 square miles of coastal lands between 1932 and 2000. During Hurricane Rita alone in 2005, areas along the Gulf Coast that had retained significant wetlands experienced much less storm surge than the areas that lacked a buffer due to coastal wetland loss. The ecological and community impacts of coastal land losses are severe. Now, climate change and associated increases in sea level rise over the next 50 to 100 years accompanied also, perhaps, by increased intensity of storms, will likely further transform large expanses of marsh to open water. Now, in New Orleans, the failure of flood control infrastructure in the wake of Hurricane Katrina made world headlines. But the New Orleans tragedy was not a lone tragedy across the nation. Go back to 2006 in California, levee failure during a heavy rainfall triggered emergency state spending to shore up infrastructure. Devastating floods continue to imperil communities. These infrastructure failures are particularly notable as natural disasters rise. Over the past century, the annual number of natural disasters has increased more than 40-fold. Fewer than 10 in the first decade to 400 to 500 in the last decades of the 20th century. Now, I want to leave this narrative, kind of depressing, on city infrastructure for a moment and turn back to the matter of climate change. Let us explore the strategies to address the effects of climate in the context of urban communities. New and continuing demands on water supplies at a time when climate change may result in less water availability in some locations put a premium on protecting and conserving water supplies. With much policy focus in cities and nationally on greenhouse gases, attention has centered often on energy, the composition of energy supplies, and implications for greenhouse gas emissions. Cities figure prominently in that discussion. City forms such as development density, city transportation systems, building design and operations, energy types can affect energy use, associated carbon dioxide emissions, and amounts of pollutions. These city structures and dynamics and their relationship to energy consumption are increasingly well understood. Indeed, this building, this very place, took into account many of those very questions to lower its environmental footprint as it was constructed and is operated. These issues are the subject of major changes in city planning, building codes, and energy investments. Less obvious are the effects of the urban natural landscape on energy use, associated air pollution, and greenhouse gas emissions. The U.S. Forest Service studies of urban forests show notable linkages between the tree canopy and urban temperatures, for example. One study of trees in Minneapolis estimated annual savings of $6.8 million in energy costs resulting from existing tree canopy. Trees can reduce heating requirements. Trees planted as windbreaks often reduce wind speed and cold air infiltration by as much as 50% and reduce heat loss for potential avoided heating costs of 10 to 12%. And of course, with that avoided heating comes also potentially, depending on your energy source, some reductions in greenhouse gases. Now, trees can also lower cooling costs if strategically located to shade buildings. Not just any old tree, any old where will do. In Atlanta, for example, shade trees were able to reduce cooling costs by 34% in some locations. And again, remember, with those reduced energy needs come also reductions in air emissions, including greenhouse gases. Now, the flip side of that equation is the increased energy costs that result from loss of tree cover. Lost tree canopy in San Antonio over a 15-year period is estimated to equate to nearly an $18 million increase in residential summer energy costs per year. More forest cover in watersheds also can reduce water treatment costs. One study of 27 water suppliers concluded that each 10% increase in forest cover in a water source area decreased treatment and chemical costs by some 20%. So restoring permeable surfacing and expanding tree canopy in cities can significantly reduce stormwater runoff and associated contaminants, with some climate models projecting increased frequency of high-intensity rainfall events. Reducing stormwater runoff becomes increasingly salient to cities as a strategy. In this context, urban greening presents a potentially important strategy using ecosystem services concepts. nature as a concept of having benefits to human communities. Portland, Oregon achieved a 95% stormwater flow reduction through bioretention. Bioretention essentially uses the chemical, biological, and physical properties of plants, microbes, and soils to reduce flows and remove pollutants from stormwater runoff. Now, Seattle reduced the volume of runoff in one neighborhood, a green pilot neighborhood, if you will, by 98% using green infrastructure. Now, that's not the end of the story. There are questions about cost, questions about long-term performance, but as a starting way of thinking differently about our infrastructure, these pilots offer some potential direction. These efforts decreased impermeable surfaces in Seattle by 11%. They replaced gravel road shoulders and surface drainage with permeable bioswales. The price tag for all this was actually 25% less than traditional infrastructure. Now, those examples highlight the significant services natural systems and their components provide to human communities, their health, their safety, and prosperity. This 21st century, I believe, can be a time for recreating natural landscapes, natural urban streams, and other permeable landscapes. It is also a time of linking city greening to broader ecosystem restoration and conservation. Though these efforts are gaining momentum and growing in extent and complexity, there are significant opportunities, to enhance the extent and effectiveness of urban greening. Embracing those opportunities, however, is not easy. It may require, and I want to mention four things, a more integrated infrastructure management, pricing incentives, the use of ecosystem services marketing tools, and cross-jurisdictional partnerships. Nature, after all, knows no boundary. We spent the 20th century dividing ourselves up into compartments and divisions. We need to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. In the Tualatin Basin in Oregon, stormwater and wastewater managers, looking at that kind of mindset, that framework, they were facing the requirement for new permits from EPA to meet water temperature standards. Under traditional approaches, they could have met those standards by getting 5 different permits, 4 for the wastewater system, 1 for stormwater, and they could have done so by investing $60 million in refrigeration systems. Instead, using an ecosystem services approach and using a more integrated construct, they combined 5 permits into a single bundle. Using trading tools already available under the Clean Water Act, they actually, instead of spending $60 million on refrigeration systems, spent $6 million to pay farmers along 37 miles of riparian area to plant trees, achieve the same temperature reduction goals. But by the way, they got some bonuses, because with those trees not only came cooler temperatures in the water, but natural spaces for biodiversity and so on. Now, through some big picture thinking and strong partnerships, not only with Environmental Protection Agency, but with the Department of Agriculture, the state, farmers, and others, those pioneers in the Tualatin Basin may be rewriting the future of watershed management. The bundled permit is, I think, clean, green, and dollar smart. Water management challenges in cities link to another significant driver for greening of city buildings, transportation, and infrastructure. That driver, as I mentioned a moment ago, is energy, its rising costs, and the greenhouse gases and other emissions associated with traditional fossil fuels. Drinking water and wastewater systems account for about 4% of U.S. electricity demand. And that may grow as we try to move water further and further from where it is to where it needs to be. Infrastructure greening can reduce energy use associated with water management, delivery, and treatment systems. For example, think of the city of New York in a much celebrated case highlighted by Gretchen Daly from Stanford University, kind of the guru of urban greening and nature's capital. In the example of the city of New York, the city was facing growing challenges of water quality. They had long benefited from the pure water coming down the Catskills Mountain, percolating through the soils, coming clean. and relatively low cost to the city. As development along the Catskills occurred, two problems arose. First, more paved landscapes meant less filtering capacity. And secondly, those developed landscapes themselves put stuff into the water. So New York finally was beginning to feel those effects in its own water supply. It faced a dilemma. Spend $8 billion or so, both to build and then manage water purification systems, or spend $1.5 to $2 billion investing in some land restoration, easements, working with some conservation and restoration efforts along the Catskill Mountain watershed. They chose the latter, $8 billion, $2 billion, not a hard decision. It avoided spending those extra dollars. The investment, though, in nature's capital did more than save money, provide clean water, and enhance habitat. The investment also translated into avoided energy use that mechanical water filtration systems would have required. Many U.S. cities are pushing this greening envelope. But expanding those efforts may require new governing tools and innovative use of existing tools. Several factors contribute to the difficulties of urban integration of greening efforts. First, and self-evidently, we all understand this, and that is agency silos. Agency silos that inhibit coordination across air, water, wastewater, stormwater, climate, energy, open space, and other infrastructure and services. In Albany, New York, for example, the city owns the wastewater plants, but it doesn't own the piping leading to the plants. This ownership segregation inhibits opportunities to rethink wastewater infrastructure and use wastewater fee revenue to revise pipe infrastructure. At the state level, similarly fractured responsibilities are common. In the state of Virginia, for example, the Department of Environmental Quality permits wastewater. The Department of Conservation and Recreation handles stormwater permits. Federal and state permitting structures that segregate planning and actions into discrete activities and issue areas make integrated ecosystem planning difficult. I want to take us across the nation on a virtual tour to Philadelphia to illustrate some of the challenges this presents. Federal and state in Philadelphia decided to try and take a more integrated urban greening approach to the challenges of managing combined sewage overflow. The greening plan would meet sewage overflow requirements while also producing cleaner air, cleaner water, more greenhouse gas reductions relative to alternative traditional investments. The plan would realign the city's infrastructure, moving it from gray to green over a period of about 30 years by converting to landscapes up to getting about 34% greening cover. Now, a traditional tunnel system to handle combined sewage overflow for the city would carry for the city a price tag of somewhere around $8 billion at a minimum. By contrast, the city reckons with $1 billion, it can achieve that 34% greening. Now, Philadelphia was able to think in an integrated way because it actually has an Office of Watershed Planning and Management. But the governing jurisdictions and political boundaries in which it operates presented some challenges, and also likewise for other cities. Seldom do those agencies align with watersheds or other ecosystem landscapes. A few cities like Seattle acquired lands a century ago that supplied the city's water supplies, but such acquisitions were infrequent, so you often have cities with their water needs here and their water supply outside the city somewhere, and that water supply under increasing pressures through development and so on. A few cities like Seattle, though, pioneered the linking of their supply with their actual use. In some cities, such as the Chesapeake Bay, you have a single watershed that includes a jumble of city and state boundaries, indeed multiple states and some 128 city jurisdictions. In other cases, like Milwaukee, you have a single city, but it's amid six different watersheds, each of them managed with a different authority. So coordinating across jurisdictional boundaries, I think, may present the single biggest governance challenge for conservation and restoration this half century. But incentives and pricing matter too. Fees that provide incentives to establish, protect, or enhance natural ecosystems and green infrastructure can motivate green investments. 3 decades ago, the city of Bellevue, Washington, established a stormwater utility, the first in the nation, and they inaugurated stormwater utility fees. Now, the city did something particularly novel in recent years. They pegged their fee not simply to road frontage, but to the amount of impervious surface and total surface area. The fees are a catalyst for conservation. Conservation that reduces the quantity of stormwater runoff and brings water quality benefits by prompting folks to think when they are working in urban contexts to use permeable rather than impermeable surfacing. Now, 3 decades ago, most stormwater utilities focused on a single goal, and that goal was managing stormwater to prevent flooding and associated erosion. The Bellevue, Washington fee structure reflects a much broader evolution in thinking of stormwater utilities toward an integrated approach to water quality, water quantity, flood protection, and preservation of habitat. The fee structure, by creating incentives for greening that reduce stormwater flows, reduces the need for additional expensive stormwater infrastructure. As cities explore the relevance of urban greening in a context of climate change impacts, they need a different policy framework and tools. The good news is some tools exist to support those transitions. The Environmental Protection Agency's model stormwater permit guidance recognizes now trees and tree planting for purposes of improving runoff control. But metrics remain a challenge. Not just any old tree or any old greening, any old where will do. We need to anchor these endeavors in good metrics. What do you get for what you're doing? Money is a challenge, too. It always is. EPA manages a grant and loan program under the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act. Those grants can support infrastructure greening and actually allow for land acquisition to protect water supplies. The funds have rarely been used for those purposes. Under the Safe Drinking Water Act, the state revolving fund loan, for example, puts forth about $787 million in grants, $1.3 billion in loans in a several-year time frame to help fund public water system infrastructure. A third of those monies, by law, are allowed to be used for greening investment in water source protection. One state is pioneering that greening focus, but just about one state and one state only. Only a couple $1 million of those funds have actually been used for greening purposes. But Ohio is taking a new tack. Ohio's program provides a loan rate reduction for wastewater treatment projects if the recipient uses the savings between the traditional rate and the lower rate for greening investments. Now, over the last 2 years, the ecosystem services of natural systems, their components, and their functions have slowly become a focus of environmental science and policy discourse. After 3 decades of outstanding academic inquiry, some policies do now, as I have mentioned, more explicitly reflect the language and intent of ecosystem services. I think several goals, and I will conclude with this, are important for shaping that framework. We do need governing tools that facilitate that regional landscape scale or watershed level set of actions. We need tools that enhance coordination across jurisdictional and property boundaries. We need tools that strengthen performance accountability through a focus on outcomes rather than prescriptions. We need incentives to nurture private stewardship and ecosystem services markets. Now, baseball philosopher, and I said this to my class the other night, baseball philosopher Yogi Berra, one of my favorite philosophers, once quipped that the future ain't what it used to be. Well, this nation, its cities, and its countryside are, I believe, at a turning point. 3 drivers require new directions. First are the environmental dynamics of climate change. Second are the increasingly landscape dimensions of resource management challenges. Third is persistent ecosystem degradation that requires new mental maps for managing cities and their surrounding environments. The 20th century was a time of immense and rapid urbanization. Vast networks of infrastructure were built to provide communities with water, waste management, transportation systems, flood protection, the list goes on and on. Accompanying those services, agencies, federal, state, and local, proliferated, fulfilling specialized and compartmentalized purposes. Through this infrastructure and these agencies, many benefits were delivered to communities. But changing circumstances are outstripping the capacities of both infrastructure and governing structures. The cumulative negative impacts of this infrastructure and its transformation of ecosystems, I believe, point to the need to rethink the nexus of city and countryside, people and places, ecosystems and economies. Addressing those challenges requires, therefore, big picture thought and action. With their urban greening efforts, cities are setting the foundations for that new future. Thank you. Because this talk is on climate, let me start with climate. I do think the nation needs climate change policy. We can't be nickel and diming or going through the back door our efforts to address the climate change and greenhouse gas challenges. So I would start with that in the sense that it sets the larger backdrop for what I will then say comes next. The second thing I think is essential is, in fact, to explore ways of creating opportunities for cross-jurisdictional, cross-property, and cross-agency governance of landscape-scale conservation. Phew, that was a big phrase. What does that mean? I don't think that means we need to completely take all the building blocks we have and disassemble them and put them back in one somehow central landscape conservation agency. Not only do I think we don't need to do that, I think it is an impossible political task to accomplish. And moreover, there are downsides to large centralizing agencies. I think instead we need some tools that better allow for cross-coordination, and I'll mention a couple. One, we need, I think, to pull some of our large landscape scale restoration projects out of discrete agency budgets and put them into a restoration and conservation budget account, in which those efforts can compete for that pool of large landscape scale restoration monies. That allows the monies from the multiple agencies, if you will, to be pooled in a single place and then reallocated to the functions and purposes required for restoration. I also think alongside that, we've got to have multi-year funding for some of this stuff. You know, one of the biggest challenges with Everglades restoration, Bay Delta up here in California, Chesapeake Bay, is that yes, there are some overall budget dollars in the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, has 200 plus projects. At one point or another, they'll end up in the Water Resources Development Act. But the actual funding for them occurs on a year-by-year basis. When you're in the Everglades and you're trying to put together Humpty Dumpty, you've got a lot of different pieces, you've got to know that if you invest in phase one or phase 1A, that you'll be able to do phase 1B. And we don't now have a structure for doing that. So, mechanisms to coordinate agencies. One tool for that is cross-agency budgeting and multi-year budgeting. We need some other tools that better allow agencies to cross-coordinate efforts. And you know, this is the kind of devilish detail you learn when you're in Washington. I learned, for example, if I'm the Park Service and I have an invasive problem in the park, that my authorities prohibit me from spending any money adjacent to the park that has the same problem, invasives problem. So if I'm on the Channel Islands and I split Santa Cruz between myself and the Nature Conservancy and I want to get rid of the fennel that has run amok, and I do that by myself without coordinating with the Nature Conservancy, eventually the problem will be right back to haunt me. Similarly, well, I won't mention the pigs in Santa Barbara. But now, in that particular instance, the Nature Conservancy was a good partner, and they both worked together to try and remove the fennel and the other challenges. That's a euphemism. But there are many locations where that kind of nexus, there's not an environmental organization right next door, you face a different kind of neighbor. There are actual prohibitions on spending money on land adjacent to you. That kind of devilish detail needs to be fixed. You basically, in the Senate, need 60 votes to get a climate bill. Right now, estimates are there may be about 43 votes, so you need 17. You probably, in that 43, you might have at most three Republicans. I think it's really difficult to imagine in the short term any compromise that will get 17 more votes in the near term. Now, that does not mean you won't get some over time. So my own estimate on the prospects for climate legislation this year, my own estimation is fairly pessimistic, not fairly, quite pessimistic. The kinds of things people talk about by way of compromise, for example, McCain, if he had a more robust nuclear set of provisions, it might bring him in and maybe a few others. The problem is that more nuclear might actually chase away some others. So you have a kind of a balancing act there. The cost issue is a big one. On the Republican side, I think the perspective remains that any climate bill is going to be costly, that right now in this dicey economic context is not the time to embark on climate, and it's really hard to see a compromise that will change that mindset. I don't think it's impossible, I mean, in the very near term, in the window that many people had hoped we'd have a climate bill this year, before Copenhagen, which is, for those who aren't steeped in climate, Copenhagen's the next big round of discussions about international climate regimes. I think it's very difficult this year. Longer term, the dynamics can change a little bit. I mean, as the economic circumstances improve, that issue of the economy becomes a little bit less salient. I also think we are beginning to see some of the tangible on-the-ground effects of a changing climate. And that's going to make a difference. Because 10 years ago, people talked in hypotheticals, looked at those models, this will happen, that will happen, this might happen, here's my speculation. Now we're actually seeing in places like Alaska, the temperature of permafrost in the inland Alaska at 0 degrees centigrade. We're seeing thawing of permafrost, and companies are seeing the risks that poses to infrastructure, the subsidence, breakage of energy pipes, roads, etc. In the West, water. You've got all those Western members of Congress, many of them more on the conservative than otherwise side, and water is becoming an increasingly, there's that old phrase, whiskey's for drinking, water's for war, but that's even more the case today, and people are recognizing it might be associated with climate. A few more big storms like Katrina, that also is starting to bring, you've got Louisiana right now, it's got a Republican governor, they wholly understand what sea level rise means to that state. And so they are actively engaged at the state level in some climate responses.
It's my understanding that the present philosophy with regards to carbon sequestration credits is that they're only available for new trees that are planted, which seems like an unreasonable distinction because ranchers and farmers that have protected their land for years and that are probably the best stewards of those lands don't get any of those credits, or at least don't have a right to them, as far as I understand.
There are people working on trying to figure out how one could do a kind of multi-credit payment where you'd get payment for the multiple benefits that your land conservation investments generate. So combining water quality credits with greenhouse gas reduction credits, et cetera, et cetera. So there are some, the Willamette Partnership up in Oregon is working on a multi-credit platform to be able to do exactly that kind of credit. And in the Chesapeake Bay, actually, they're also similarly trying to work on that kind of construct. The state of Florida has a Florida Ranchlands Conservation, that's not the title, but Florida Ranchland Preservation Program or something, and it's a credit trading program where farmers are being paid to maintain water quality, but also looking at greenhouse gas emission reduction. So these things are happening. The example I gave did not include carbon credits. The second issue you raise is a real biggie. And here's the conceptual policy dilemma. First, let me say I have great sympathy for the point you made. I serve on a commission on climate and tropical forests. And one of the things that landowners in Brazil say, for example, is precisely that. Look at me. I'm the guy that actually protected this tropical forest. And I don't get to participate in a carbon market. It's the guy that chopped them down and is reforesting that gets to participate. How fair is that? So I am sympathetic. On the other hand, here's the challenge. You know, carbon credits are all about, and offsets, are all about being able to demonstrate that you're generating new reductions in greenhouse gases. So I'm a, let's say, electric utility. I buy an offset by paying someone to plant trees. I'm able to demonstrate that that's a new generation of emission reduction, if you will. And so you have a dilemma because the trees that are already there are already doing their ecosystem service job with respect to carbon sequestration. So what a lot of people are looking at is whether there might be other kinds of payments for that kind of circumstance. So for example, there's a lot of look at the Conservation Reserve Program, the U.S. State Forestry Grant Program is also looking at competitive grants that would focus on payments for preservation, if you will. So it may be that you won't be able to play into an offset market, but nonetheless play into some other kind of ecosystem services benefits context.
If those folks had a right to some kind of monetary compensation for maintaining those trees, I think you would enhance the environment.
It's a good observation, and there's, I think, a growing recognition that linking the benefits of conservation, if you will, whether in the carbon context, water context, or otherwise, to economic well-being is a more sustainable pathway than just focusing on one to the exclusion of the other.
I find it frightening that we have to have more Katrinas before we may get some action that really is meaningful. Is this what we have to look forward to? Because I do believe that time is running out myself. As you articulated, the greenhouse gases will be there for a long time. And so are we just going to be questioning how hot it gets and how severe all of these climate changes are? I'd like to hear some hope.
I hope things will be well. You know, there's that old Churchill phrase that democracy is the worst kind of government ever invented except for anything else. It is slow. I think, though, we already have had some crises that have been a wake-up call. We will continue to have some cumulatively, and I would hope not in the too distant future, that will galvanize to bring some action. But you're right. Washington is a challenging place. I am a Pollyanna. In fact, I was known as the rosy-colored glasses person at the department. And part of what enabled me to do that was to look at the trees instead of the forest. If you look at the big picture, and you look at Washington, you do see a lumbering giant, if you will. You see people often mired in molasses. The great and exhilarating thing is the incredible dispersed conservation actions of a growing scale that are occurring across the landscape. Whether I look at the Blackfoot Challenge in Montana, the Northwest Marine States Straits Initiative in three states along the Northwest, even things like the Chesapeake Bay and Everglades, even though they're lumbering along, nonetheless they are moving in a constructive direction. So that's what gives me hope. And as we get more of those endeavors, what we are starting to see is they themselves are now striving to link so that the whole is bigger than the sum of the parts. And then, you know, people have always said Congress follows, they don't lead. So
you've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.